This is World Radio KHOE 90.5 FM, and you are listening to the program A Chat with the Dean. I am Kathy Guarini. I'm Dean of Faculty at Maharshi University of Management, and I have with me today Dr. David Orm Johnson, one of the lead researchers in Transcendental Meditation. And the first question I have for you, David, is how did you find out about Transcendental Meditation?
I heard about it from a friend, I guess, like a lot of people. So my best friend from high school, Clint, was always trying things out in the 60s, and every time I'd open the door, there would be this different person, red hair sticking straight out, you know, acid, that's the thing. And another time, he's dressed like a Native American who'd been spending time in northern New Mexico with the Indians, learning all of their lore. So Rhoda and I went to visit him in New York in 1968, and I was in graduate school at that time. And they opened the door, and here's the most reasonable, balanced version of himself. And I said, well, what are you doing now? And it was Transcendental Meditation. So he was in New York. He actually went to the airport and met Maharshi and met Mike Love. Maharshi was there with the Beach Boys. And so he told us all about it. And then when he went to meditate, I went in a room and I just, whatever I imagined meditation to be. But I actually didn't get to learn until about 2 years later after I got my PhD. And I was teaching at the University of Texas in El Paso. And I was walking by a bulletin board, and I'm not the kind of person who ever looks at a bulletin board. But Rhoda is. She reads everything, you know, and that's great for her. But anyway, it keeps us informed, but some force like took my head, and I looked over, and there's this little handwritten note, and it said, "Want to enjoy life more? Lecture on Transcendental Meditation." This was in 1970, and I thought that's what he was talking about, you know, because there were no the teachers weren't available, and so we went to the lecture, and it was Casey Coleman, and there was just some vibe about him that I knew this was it. I just wanted that. And Rhoda said, well, you know, he seems a little nervous. He has to drink water. And we took another friend. So they decided they would wait and see what happened to me. So that afternoon, we're in the park with Nate, who at that time was about a year and a half old, I guess. Actually, more about 2 and a half. Anyway, he's playing and everything. I'm feeling totally relaxed. I used to feel very anxious in wide open spaces. I actually had these kind of, I shouldn't tell us about myself, but these fantasies of someone, a sniper, aiming at me. It was pretty intense, and I had that for years, ever since I was a teenager. And at this time, I was now 29 when I learned. And Rhoda saw immediately that, you know, there was some major thing had happened here, and so she wanted to learn. She didn't get to learn until 6 months later when Robert Winquest came through town to teach another course, and I always razz her that I'm a longer-term meditator than her. Anyway, so that's how I learned. That's how I heard about it. That's how I learned, from a friend.
And I want to ask also about how you started research on Transcendental Meditation, but let's go back a little bit before that, and what did you get your PhD in, and what were you interested in researching at that time?
Well, I got my PhD in experimental psychology, and I went to Columbia as interested in physics, but the competition was pretty stiff. There were these Chinese kids that already had advanced calculus, and these kids from Bronx Science. And I remember there was another kid who grew up in Los Alamos, and he held several patents already. His whole father was a physicist, his uncle was a physicist, you know, he just grew up in that. And so they were way more prepared, and it seemed that, you know, the level that they were getting into it was just so technical and everything. And going from El Paso, Texas, to New York City, I was very aware of social issues.
is that where you grew up?
I grew up. I was born and raised in El Paso, Texas. So that was quite a transition and a culture shock. But anyway, it's another story. But anyway, so then I went into anthropology. I thought that would be really interesting. And I was really interested in cultural anthropology and reading stories about different cultures, about different the Cheyenne and, you know, the Tiwi of Northern Australia. But as I looked at the careers of, and Margaret Mead was at Columbia, so it was really exciting. But when I looked at the career of anthropologists, what I saw was is that you had to really be able, good at languages, so that when you lived with people, you know, you found out in detail what they really were about. You had some depth of communicating with them. And I was terrible at languages. That was my first topic. And also I noticed that their careers tend to be maybe one time they would go off and do some study of some culture, and then from then on they became academics and they were hanging around universities and teaching classes. And I absolutely did not want to be an academic. Ironically, so ended up that's what I did. So I did that for a year or so, and then I Anyway, I went into experimental psychology, and at that time at Columbia it was operant conditioning. The head of the department had been roommate of B.F. Skinner. And
what is operant conditioning?
Behaviorism. Uh-huh. It's the view that consciousness does not really exist except as an epiphenomenon, and and that you can explain human behavior completely in terms of interaction with the environment, stimulus response, you know, that whole thing. And Pavlov is part of that whole picture, and Skinner, and J.B. Watson, and, you know, conditioning and phobias and all of that. And what I liked about it was is it was scientific. My brother was sort of a genius scientist, and he was, you know, there was this radio program called the Whiz Kids, and my brother was a Whiz Kid, and he skipped grades. He ended up a full tenured professor at MIT in chemistry, and he had a laboratory when we grew up in a sort of rural area, but we had a chicken coop which was fully equipped, you know, with all sorts of beakers and Bunsen burners and distillation, you know, columns and all these different things. So anyway, I used to follow my brother around and doing all these amazing things. So I was really interested in science, and I was also interested in art and being in New York and painting and all that. But so I liked the operant conditioning because it was a very scientific, you know, approach. And I ended up studying, you know, models of stress and stuff, and with animals and pigeons pecking keys and rats pushing levers. And one job I had was working in a brain stimulation laboratory, and they were mapping out the brains, looking at the different pleasure centers and, you know, reward centers in the brain. It was all, you know, leading edge stuff at that time. And but I also was interested in art, and so when I graduated, I went into sculpting, actually, because I was doing art all along, and actually I had enough enough courses in art to have a major, actually, and I had straight A's in art. I couldn't say that for my other topics. So when we went back to El Paso, and I was teaching at the University of Texas at El Paso, as I said, when I learned TM and saw the note on the mm-hmm. bulletin board. But I was actually, the main thing I was doing was sculpting. The family business was the structural steel, and in the summertime I had learned how to weld and things. So I was welding these big sculptures, you know, full-size people mm-hmm. and fountains and all these different things. And after I started meditating, I went to a residence course within the first 2 weeks. Actually, Denise Denniston led it, and it was in Tucson. And it was such an amazing experience to be around people and to meditate. And I was nervous around people, to meditate with them. And I came out, and suddenly you're in this different world, and mm-hmm. all this sort of bliss flowing between people, the generations talking to each other. I was so impressed that there were people of different color, but also of different generations. You know, there were older people talking with younger people, older people in those days, meaning middle-aged. I was 29. And that was really remarkable, because that was the time of the generation gap. You know, you didn't trust anybody over 30. That was the thing. And when we came home, when we're driving across the desert after that residence course, I felt like I was in a IMAX movie with just super awareness, you know, and we're just driving along in this incredible landscape flowing by. And we stopped at a gas station which had a little store there, and there was a hippie bus there, all painted, you know, covered with colors, and a swarm of hippies was inside, sort of barely clad, and, you know, dressed hippie style, beards, long hair, dirty, the whole thing. And there was this huge tension between them and the local Arizona kids who were running the store and behind the cash register. And I could see the Arizona kids giving them these, you know, death looks and, you know, these dagger looks and everything. And the hippies totally oblivious to the whole thing, or if not oblivious, sort of playing with them, with their minds. And I realized that what Marshy had done, my experience in the residence course, where everybody was so integrated, that this was the solution to the problems of society, to these huge gaps that were in society between the generations and between the races. And that was, after 2 weeks of TM, it was amazing. It was just amazing.
And when was the first time you heard about scientific research on transcendental meditation? Because Keith Wallace would have been doing it.
Yeah, he was.
At that point.
And I remember Casey mentioned that there was some research going on, but he didn't know much about it. And but it hadn't been published yet. It came out, I think, a month or two after I learned TM. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I was going to say, and on that residence course, I had this vision that this was really a great thing, but it needed research. And even though I was really like being a sculptor and all, I was really trained to be a researcher, although everything I learned wasn't really applicable for anything that I did on TM. I learned all these areas since then, you know, about the physiology. And I remember reading Keith's paper, and it seemed like it was like a foreign language. I had not studied. I took some courses in physiological psychology, but things like metabolic rate and, you know, vital capacity and, you know, the EEG, I knew sort of vaguely about them, but I really didn't know anything about them, and so I started learning. And so the way I got into research, I'm not letting you ask any questions.
This is exactly what I want.
Okay.
I just want you to talk.
Okay. So I was teaching part-time to kind of make ends meet, keep the family together, and by that time, Sarah came along, so we had two kids. And one of my students said, what's this? There was this sort of storage room in the psychology department had, and it had some old equipment in it. And he said, what's this thing? And it was a polygraph. I'd never used a polygraph, but I'd read about the GSR, or skin resistance, and all that. So I fixed it up. I was pretty good with electronics and stuff like that, and got it going, and started doing a demonstration with the class. And I saw that the meditating students, some of the meditators, started taking my mm-hmm. class and all that because they thought that would be fun. Were recovering faster from the stress than the non-meditators.
From what stress?
Well, the stress.
Well, you were stressing them out?
Yes, it was from my rat days. They wore earphones. I found an audiometer, you know, that played different tones and stuff. So I was playing a loud noise in there for about a second in their ears. It was about 100 decibels.
So it was unpleasant?
It's about as loud as if you put your head in a big bell and someone hit on it. You wouldn't want to do it for very long. But on the short term like that, it was at a level at 100 decibels. It wasn't, supposedly would not create any damage. So I have some karma from that, which I've had to go through. But anyway, and what I found was is that, as I said, that when you present these stressors, the physiology responds. There's a stress response to it. And what it is, it's an adaptive thing. You're getting ready to deal with something, and so the palms begin to sweat as part of it. And a number of other things happen, mm-hmm. but that's what I was measuring. But then it recovered faster. And also the non-meditators tended to make more responses to the first time. It's like they responded, and then, people who are highly stressed, something happens, and they keep carrying on about it. The meditators responded, very clear response, a very simple kind of waveform, and it recovered more quickly. So then I started reading about, learning this whole field.
So you had, when you were testing them, you were just seeing how it worked or something? You weren't thinking the meditators would be different?
Well, there actually was a motivation for doing this particular thing. I found with myself, one of the benefits of meditating was that I found that I no longer was compelled to clean my plate, even though I belonged to Uncle Roy's Clean Your Plate Club from being a little kid. And so I thought, this is really profound. And the way from my background and behavioral, mm-hmm. you know, the way you would understand this is it's a, that this compulsion to eat and those kinds of things are their conditioned responses. So I'm thinking, how are these conditioned responses going away during meditation? So I wanted to make an experimental model where I condition someone to a stimulus. So like you ring the bell, a loud tone, and then you ring the bell and they show their stress response. That was my plan.
Uh-huh.
And then I was going to see if the meditators extinguished faster, if they conditioned differently. That was what I never did that experiment. Because what I found was simpler. If you just play the stressor, they responded different. And then I found something even simpler than that. I found that if you turn up the sensitivity of the GSR machine, you see that people have these very small little stress responses going on all the time, and people are different. And I found that there was a whole literature on that. And the literature was studying it in terms of the negative side of it, studying anxiety, lability, autonomic lability.
What's lability?
Lability means instability.
So if you have a lot of lability, you're like unstable.
If your blood pressure is labile, that's a predictor of heart disease and hypertension, for example. So if the system is a little unstable. So I found that the meditators were more stable. If you didn't have to stress them or anything. You could just have them sit down, you know, in a standard situation with their eyes closed. And then you'd have them meditating and then eyes closed again. That was the paradigm, and the control subjects were sitting with eyes closed and continued sitting with eyes closed and then had the post period. So the difference being they didn't meditate. Well, the meditators had fewer of these stress responses, these spontaneous skin resistance responses, as they're called, compared with the control group, and they became even more stable during TM. Years later, Michael Dilbeck and I did a meta-analysis of all the research that had been done, and autonomic stability, having greater autonomic stability, was something that was consistent across many different experiments, or 32 different experiments, and so it turned out to be true. So anyway, which I was happy to find.
And how long had these students been meditating? Probably not
just
very long?
Not very long, yeah. Couple of years, most people, 2 or 3 years at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so one experience at that time, I was reading about this, and I was sharing an office with this guy, he's a literature student or something, and had a great big table, and I had all of these reprints about autonomic stability and about habituation. I was finding out all these interesting things that it was correlated with, for example, the Air Force found that people who were more stable were stronger when you stress them with G-force. They put them in a centrifuge and spun them around until they passed out, which they were doing to trying to find different ways to predict who could be a good fighter pilot, because the pilot has to endure these amazing G-forces as they're doing their various maneuvers. And so that was one thing, and it was related to a psychological trait called ego strength, which means overall resiliency and ability to deal with life. And it was correlated with field independence. People who were more stable, their perception tended to be more organized, and they had the ability to find focus and broad comprehension. And so all these amazing things, which I got to tell Marcy about at one point, the first time I met him. So other graduate student, I'm reading all this stuff and I have these papers spread all over the table in her office, and he said, "What are you doing?" So I just thought, I'll just tell him how I saw what I was doing. I said, "This is the end of psychosomatic problems in the world. I've discovered this thing, TM, and he goes, "Whoa." I was surprised that he responded so positively. Said he did, he was just like, "Really? That's really good." Anyway, so I knew from the beginning that this was something extraordinary, the NTM, and doing the research on it, I was able to see this. And it was so exciting because, the initiators would talk about you become less stressed and so forth. And I thought, my God, we can measure that. And looking at the whole 40 years of doing research with all these other guys, like Keith and everybody, it's so amazing that, that what we're doing is being able to show scientifically enlightenment. Enlightenment's been around for as long as anyone knows, and I guess as we're finding, it's in all cultures. There's you know, Buddhism and you know, and the Greek tradition and so forth. And but what we're doing, it's so amazing that you can measure what's happening, and it's, you know, that the physiology is changing.
So when did you do your first published research?
Well, the one on autonomic stability, I worked into a study, you know, after I did my pilot thing and saw something was going on. And I wrote up a paper and submitted it to Psychosomatic Medicine, which was a leading journal, and really the only journal on what now would be called mind-body medicine at that time. It was started right after the Second World War, and many of the classic papers in the field of psychophysiology, which is about the relationship between the body and the mind, you know, papers on what is the physiology of fear, what is the physiology of anger, and measuring different hormones and different way the body responds. So I was very lucky that I got in that. In 1973, it took a while to get it done, it came out. Yeah. And
then how did you get connected with Maharshi? That's a big question.
Yeah, what happened was Dmitri Kanellakos, and Paul Levine and several people who were doing research on TM started communicating. I don't know how we communicated. There was no internet.
Maybe you wrote letters.
I can't conceive that we actually did that, but it must have happened that way. And in passing papers around, and Dmitri was so enthusiastic and organizing and so.
So somehow they read your paper, or
well,
you?
We knew about each other, and uh-huh. It started a kind of organization of people who were interested uh-huh. in doing research uh-huh. on TM. The other thing that did happen, I was inspired to write a letter to Maharshi describing what I was doing, and it was the autonomic stability. And there was another thing that I did, was a perceptual motor thing, where I, it was called a pursuit rotor, where the person holds a stylus on this thing that's going around like a record on a record. It has a target on it, and at first you're really terrible at it, you get better. what I was looking for was before and after meditation, if there was a change, you know. So I had them do this thing, and then they meditated, or the control group just sat there with their eyes closed, and then they came back and did it again. Well, I didn't find what I expected. Both groups got better after the rest, mm-hmm. and that turns out to be pretty well known, that if you have someone learning something and you give them a rest, regular rest, just doing anything, they tend to come back at a better level. But what was different was the meditators learned faster. They started at the same level of mm-hmm. not so good yeah. at it, but they adapted faster. So anyway, I put that in my letter, very carefully wrote this letter, and I rewrote it several times so it sounded just right. And I sent it off to Jerry Jarvis, and I got a letter back, and he said, Maharshi was really, really impressed with your research. And I got a letter from Maharshi, and it said, a guru's blessing. It had this beautiful stationery with the gold thing on Maharshi. It was so sattvic, this piece of paper, and it blew me away, but it was, so anyway, that's how they, through Dmitri and through my letter to Jerry Jarvis, they knew why I was doing research. And it was a big deal then, because, you know, in those days, in the early 70s, mostly was the Sims people learning, and you know, if you were over 25, it was like really amazing. Someone who's a real grown up is learning, and if a professor learned, that became, you know, international news. And if someone doing research learned or was doing research, you know, that became a big deal. So I was lucky to get in on an early level like that, and we were invited to go to Humboldt. I think it was Humboldt too, and we stayed with, and I got to present my research and to talk to Maharshi about it at one point, which I'll tell you about.
Yeah, yeah.
But we were with the SRM group, you know, Mother Olson and those people. And remember, my background was behaviorism. If you made a scale of knowledge going from the most materialistic, consciousness doesn't even exist, to the completely other end, Vedanta, everything is consciousness, I was at the far left end. it.
But that wasn't so much your choice as just what you had learned about.
Yeah, that's
right?
What I learned. I always knew that wasn't the whole story. Mm-hmm. When I started TM, I don't know where it came from, but I knew that I had other lines and all this. I didn't know what they were. But it was sort of this big opening up, and I started reading stuff. That was another thing that happened right away, reading stuff I never read before. And all the meditators were into things like astrology and stuff. I mean, I'd written the papers that showing how astrology had been taken over by astronomy, and it was sort of an early kind of vague sort of thing that history has dropped off, and now we were into the real thing. So that's where I was coming from. So here we are in Humboldt, Rhoda and I. And these people, they're talking about, and Marshy's talking about being, and, his first thing he said when he walked in, he said, human life is between two infinities. I thought, I don't know what he's talking about. I'm going to write it down. I looked at each other and started writing it down. Anyway, so during these group meetings with the SRM people, Mother Olson and so forth, they're all talking about this really esoteric stuff that Nadia Marshy was talking about, this 47th astral plane, da da da, and they're going to all these details, and I felt like I was schizophrenic. I could not connect with the words they were saying, and my head was spinning, literally. I was about to faint. So I said, can we talk about what Marshy talks about? And then they went, oh, yes, of course. They're all like really embarrassed. And they said, so we would talk about SCI and what Marshy was saying. And then at one point, Mother Olson said, well, David, they knew I had a PhD and all that. It was coming from the other kind of world from where they were. But they were very nice. And they said, well, what do you think about Marshy's knowledge? And I said, well, I really like everything, but except this being thing. Do you think that's important? So they all got a good laugh. And reflecting back on that, it's like my dharma, karma, is to explain it from behaviorism to bring in, because I know that ignorant, that level of ignorance. And recently I was reading Vernon Katz's book, Conversations with Marshy, and I think about page 70, he has this wonderful conversation where he's talking to Marshy about the value of discussion. And apparently Vernon had already been writing quite a bit, and he was reporting Marshy what he was doing, and he said, Marshy, I have all this negativity where I'm challenging you, and I'm, trying to contradict you and find loopholes in your logic, and should we take all that out? And Marshy said, no. He said, you're the voice of our age. It's like the Brahman is there, it's fullness, but it can go any direction, and it has to go to all, Marshy said, to the far reaches of ignorance, that's part of it. If it doesn't, it's not Brahman. He said that's the value of it. It's the value of having Vernon there with his very critical, watching every, point that Marshy makes. He said, you're helping bring that out. And so, I thought all of us who were around Marshy with these various academic degrees and things, but that was our experience. We gave a channel for Brahman to flow, which is relevant to the age that we're in, because we're totally steeped, in our own age and our own education. And so he brought that being, that totality, as to the whatever extent we could absorb it, and we're still absorbing it, into different aspects of society. So we had that role. So even though we were totally ignorant, holding up our sticks, there was some value that it gave some directionality for the infinite to flow, to become relevant and understandable to this age that we live in. And the science is part of that whole story.
Yeah. After that first meeting, you must have started doing more research. In what ways did Maharshi suggest research or direct research or encourage you?
He listened to everything. The first time I got to talk to him was I was on teacher training in Fuji. I mean, actually, I got to talk to him once before. The very first time in Humboldt, Jerry introduced me, and I started in stressing so much that, again, I whole perception, everything, I was blah, 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 blah. I was just And I found myself talking to Jerry. Jerry was sort of trying to focus me and bring me back. And Marcy had moved on. It was good. And I was over this guy. Wait, I didn't get to talk to you. I couldn't focus or anything. The way I would image it would be like if every iron atom has a dipole, has a magnetic pole, a plus and a minus. And if they're all jumbled in all different directions, then if that piece of iron came near a powerful magnet, the whole internal structure of that thing of iron would start realigning itself to that powerful force. And that was like my experience. I was so out of balance and so forth. It all started normalizing so quickly. So it wasn't until teacher training that I actually got coherent enough that I could really talk to Marcia very much. I got to talk to him another time at home, but it was a little bit better. But anyway, I got a knock on the door. I was rounding, and he said someone wants to talk to you. So anyway, I got to go up there, and Keith was there, and he wanted to hear about my research. So I started telling him about autonomic stability and the habituation thing. And what he wanted to know, everything. He wanted to know all the things it was correlated with. And that's what he liked most. He said, that from this one finding, you can derive all of these many, many different benefits. And so that was the angle that he liked. And I was really sad that I ran out of things to say at a certain point, and I was ended it. But while we were talking, this is another sort of side story, there was this guy there taking photographs. And I thought maybe he's an official photographer from our system. I didn't know anything. And so I thought to myself, gee, I'd really like to have a photograph of me talking to Marcy. and then I looked over, Marcy kind of looked at me like he read my mind, and I got the thought, yes, you could have that. And then we're back into the conversation, and finally I ran out of things to say, and it was over, and I tried to say it again, and it was obviously over. Anyway, so it was time to go, and I looked around, the guy disappeared. And I thought, oh, well, that's the end of that. I have no idea who he was, or I think I asked Keith that he didn't know who he was. About a year later, maybe 6 months later, one of my friends went to another Humboldt, and he said after the lecture, he was outside the lecture hall, someone had a big pile of photographs they were selling, he was leafing through them, and there was a photograph of me talking to Marcy. He bought it and brought it to me in El Paso. And I thought, this is how the absolute, it's unfathomable how the infinite can, but I've said it many times being around Marcy where things like that would happen, where you could not give any kind of classical explanation for how it happened, yet it happened.
You're listening right now to World Radio, KHOE 90.5 FM. This is the show, A Chat with the Dean. I am Kathy Guarini, Dean of Faculty, and I have with me Dr. David Orme Johnson, one of the original researchers on the Transcendental Meditation Technique. And we've just been talking about your first encounters with Maharshi. And so when was it? So you were in teacher training, and then after that, did you go back to teaching TM or teaching at the university or research or?
Yeah, we went back to El Paso, and I continued teaching, and the faculty there were very interested, and they said, "Well, have you given up, psychology?" And I thought about it. I thought, no, everything that I learned and everything is there, but instead of being my whole world, it's now shrunk down to a little point, and there's this huge, vast kind of context now, for the whole thing. But we taught TM, and that our house became the TM center. We were some of the older ones, by that time I was 31. And all the other meditators were like 10 years younger, like 20. So we had a house, and the initiators stayed there, and they initiated at our house, and we organized, and we went to all the lectures. We were really interested in the whole thing. And we each taught about 80 or 90 people, and had some amazing experiences. El Paso's in the desert, and it would rain, when we initiated, which is very unusual and quite amazing, and things like that. But you were asking about Marcy guiding the research, I got into how he was interested in hearing about everything. That was sort of a lead into that. I got sidetracked. So Marshy was always interested in hearing about the research. So one day, a bunch of us scientists were sitting around Paul Levine, and who really developed the COSPAR, the coherence displays, and others were listening to Jean-Paul Bonquet tell about his research on EEG. And he's talking about this, and he sees alpha, which Keith had also found, and he also saw some other things. And then he mentions that he saw synchrony between the left and right side of the brain and between the front and back of the brain. And Marcia is sitting there, you know.
And this was on, Bonquet had been doing research on meditators.
Bonquet had been doing research on TM in Paris.
Uh-huh.
And so he was one of the early researchers that, you know, that we all got heard about and got to know and got invited over to talk about what he was doing. And Marshy, you know, he's listening and he's making notes and asking questions, and suddenly synchrony. It's like he just sort of focused on that. He said, you know, he saw this as the idea of coherence, or that the whole brain is working together in an organized way. He saw in it that this is unity, you know, this is where the information that is, you know, the unique information. And so Paul Levine, physicist, MIT, you know, and Caltech trained, and so he knows some measures from interstellar interferometry. I can talk to Kathy this way. Yeah, which they measure coherence, you know, which is the degree to which the waves are lined up with each other or in phase with each other. You know, technically, it's the stability of the phase angle at certain frequencies, which you find through a fast Fourier transform.
Right.
And so he developed this measure and way of displaying it called, which he named the coherent spectral array. And and so that was very exciting.
And he had developed that for his physics research or for meditation?
He knew of this measure from physics, and he applied it to the EEG. And there was another guy, I forgot Gibbon's first name, but anyway, he had also used coherence. A couple of people had used coherence a little bit, but no one like we did. And so Paul found that, you know, the meditators show these coherent effects, and many people probably have seen, if I don't know if they remember, but these coherent spectral arrays that you're looking along, and then these little blips come up like mountain peaks at certain frequencies, and the people who've been meditating a long time and had amazing experiences showed lots of these mountain peaks at different and different frequency bands. And so that was really exciting, and that developed into looking at what happened during specific periods of transcending. And there was a Lebanese guy there from Paris named Karadine Badawi. And Karadine did a study looking at what happened to the EEG during respiratory suspension, you know, when your breath stops, which was this really good marker of transcending, and also became more autonomically stable at that time. What he found was that all the different frequencies of the EEG became more coherent at that time. So it was just like this total coherence of the different frequencies have different functions in the brain. I won't go into it right now. Alert, I just heard Alert talking about that. Right? Anyway, but they all became more coherent. And so that was really exciting. And then, but there wasn't any literature on coherence, except that when someone's under epilepsy, having an epileptic fit, the whole brain kind of gyrates together, but it's at a completely different frequency. It's this very low frequency thing, you know, when you're having an epileptic fit. And so to the medical and scientific community, you know, you had to be careful talking about synchrony, because they thought, oh yeah, epilepsy, you know what that, oh yeah. No one knew really what its functional significance was of this alpha, which is a whole different frequency from the what it did. So I thought, couldn't find anything about it, you know, in the literature. So I thought, oh, we'll do some simple kind of experiments. Just as a trait, people differ in the level of how coherent their brain is, say, while they're meditating. There's different levels. And it gets more coherent when you're meditating than when you're not. let's see if that's correlated with the trait of, say, creativity. So we gave people creativity tests. We measured their coherence. And lo and behold, there was a correlation. And there's a thing on that too. I was director of the laboratory, but I was on the 6 month course when they were doing this, and I was talking to Russell Hebert. I used to call him Hebert, but it's Hebert. Anyway, and I was really having these deep experiences. Anyway, I was talking to Russell. I could see Russell's mind working and sort of finishing sentences for him. But anyway, I said, he said, well, we're not finding this or that. And I said, look at the correlation between coherence, EEG coherence, alpha EEG coherence, and creativity. And I said, and it will be about... And in my mind, it was like going up and down a scale of values, and it just sort of settled on one. I said, it'll be about 0.72. Next day, Russell comes back, and he said, we did the correlation, and it was 0.72. He was just totally amazed. So anyway, but so we started doing that kind of experiment to show that an interpretation of what coherence was, you know, what is the EEG coherence? Well... But we're sort of the only ones who are doing that kind of research. Well, now, this is 30 years later, there's been a huge amount of research on EEG coherence around the world, finding that alpha coherence has this functional ability to integrate long-range spatial integration of the brain. We actually almost use those exact words in the catalog. But when we were using it, it was pretty much on a theoretical level. Larry Domesh... talking about the coherence, you have coherence between the front of the brain, the back of the brain, and so the whole thing is in the left and right hemisphere. You can see in the original MIU catalog, they were talking about increasing coherence, and we're interpreting that this will bring together the functioning of the left and the right, and then so they work together, the artist and the scientist working together, the self-referral front part of the brain working with the object referral back part of the brain. But I wouldn't use the words making it up exactly. We, you know, there was a lot of theoretical reasons for it, but there wasn't much empirical evidence for it except for, you know, a few studies that we had done on these correlational things. But now it's like there's dozens of studies showing that on every level of activity, whether it's, you know, on all the levels of the mind, whether it's a perceptual motor thing or whether it's a sensory thing or whether it's memory learning things, That what alpha coherence does is it organizes the different parts of the brain to work together. The brain has these different functions, which are separated, you know, spatially from each other. And in order to do a particular task, it puts together a working group. And that keeps changing, you know, second by second. But the coherence is the organizing. It's like the conductor, you know, organizing the orchestra. And so it's now become kind of mainstream. Russell sent one of his papers on synchrony, showing that this coherence of all synchrony between all the different parts of the brain during TM compared with just if you're just resting, and to one of the guys who'd written this big review on the functional significance of synchrony and coherence. And then the guy wrote back and he said, the field of EEG is playing right into your hand. So this is a huge story that Fred has really been doing great work, and Howard and Keith. And but most people don't know the story yet, how profound it is. So one of the things I'm doing right now is sort of, I don't have to do any research. I don't have to teach anyone anything. And so I have this luxury to be able to kind of look over, you know, what people are doing and to synthesize it and read the literature and so forth. So that's sort of what I'm doing now is trying to bring that out, you know, and write papers on it, to technical papers, and then also for our initiators so they know that they're this amazing thing. Of course, it'll sound the same old thing we've always been saying, but it's wonderful, yeah. You know, as a scientist to know that it's really well-established fact now that coherence really is, that alpha coherence really is organizing the brain.
Well, that's one of my favorite charts where the EEG coherence is in the middle and all the correlations to all the different
things. Yeah, yeah. Margie designed that chart with me, but I gave him the data and stuff, and he's sitting there doodling, and he drew that chart. He drew the coherence in the middle, and then he did the things around, and he drew lines, and then I put numbers on those. But Marcy actually designed that chart.
I love that chart. And were you there when the first this 1% study was presented to Marcy?
Yes, I actually told him about it. It was Garland Landreth was here at MIU in the psychology department, and the year before, Marcy had been talking about the 1% effect, and actually, in 1960, Marcy talked about the 1% effect, and in Vernon's Katz's book, Conversations with Marcy, he actually has a footnote, and he tells exactly where it was. It was in Austria, and it was in some newspaper that printed that, and Marcy said even 1% would be enough to improve society and reduce the crime and so forth. So we have a reference for that now, which is really nice. But we were in Switzerland with Marcy, and I got telex. Yes, I got a telex. We always use the movement. Always use the latest whatever technology. But anyway, I got a telex from Garland. Garland kind of took it seriously, and he looked into the statistics. He got statistics from Jerry Jarvis International, how many people learned in different cities, and he found that there were 4 1% cities in the Midwest. Iowa City and Ames were a couple of them, and Lawrence, Kansas, and I don't remember the fourth. But anyway. And he looked at the year afterwards, the crime went down in all of them. And then he looked at other cities that were also in the Midwest, also college towns, and the crime just kept going up, as it had been year by year before. Those 4 cities was enough for Marcy to proclaim the dawn of the Age of Enlightenment. He said, through the window of science, we see the dawn of Age of Enlightenment. And one time he commented, if we want to be humorous, we say, through the window of science, we see down at the edge of my nose. But he used that. And, you know, since then, there's been 50 studies, you know, on it. Because I'm thinking, you know, this is not very much evidence yet. And it was quickly expanded to all of the cities, 1% cities, by Candace Borland and Garland. And that was in Collected Papers, Volume 1. And then Michael Dilbeck was able to get statistics on even smaller towns by going to actually to the local police departments. Garland used the FBI statistics, but they have a cutoff. I think it's only towns over 20,000 or something that you can get the statistics. So Michael knew that there were a lot of smaller towns that had 1%, and he found 48 cities, and that was published also. It was really fulfilling to see it grow from a discovery on 4 cities and then 48 cities. And then Michael did a random sample of 120, I think, cities in all, but like 40 large ones and 40 medium-sized ones and 40 small ones. And he did a correlation between the percentage of meditators in the population and the change in crime or change in crime trend in the following years. And he found that the rise of the increase in the percent meditators predicted the change in crime in following years, that year and the following years. And it didn't work the other way. So it was a causal, it showed a causal relationship. So that is very exciting, and then we were able to do these actual studies where you created groups when the idea of the TM City program came along.
So when the TM City program came along, and Maharshi was talking about the the Maharshi effect, but the super radiance and the square root of 1%. How did that start?
Well, it was 1978, and since the 1% thing had been shown for a summer project for all the initiators and all of us, he said, let's have an ideal society campaign and go around to all of the would select a province or a state and around the world, and initiators would go there. They'd focus on in the U.S. it was Rhode Island and Washington State.
So his original idea for the ideal society campaign was to look at the Maharshi effect.
The original idea was to inspire them to get 1%.
Uh-huh. 1% meditating.
Yeah, inspire them to get 1%. What we found was that the group, the initiators were there in groups, and by that time they were siddhas, and this was 78. So effects were seen just by them being there, doing their
even facilities. Before they had a chance to initiate.
Yeah, and not everybody, Marcy. Paisley proposed this, that if people had done it, it would have been a different world. But the city governments at all, they love talking to us, because I went around with John Shearer and we talked to people, and we would have a half an hour meeting with them, and they'd keep us there for 2 hours, you know, because they just love being with us. But they never did do anything, you know, actually. But anyway, what came out, and there were some initiations, but not getting 1%. But what happened, it was discovered that even the groups would create this effect. So Barshi came up with this idea that the group dynamics, that you needed a smaller number, the square root of 1%. And then there was this newspaper article that someone read to him from Nicaragua, and this sort of simple peasant lady was quoted as saying, "Help, if anyone can help us, please help." So Marshy did, and he sent, you know, groups of now Purusha, but single men, not all Purusha, but, you know, there were single initiators. The men, the ladies, were too delicate to go in the war zones. He sent them to the trouble spot countries of the world. So this became this project to send to the trouble spot countries. And that was in Central America. Nicaragua was in a revolution. And so he sent to all the different Central American countries, you know, groups of meditating together, doing the program together, as well as to Iran and to Israel and to Rhodesia, you know, in southern Africa, wherever there was hotspots, which was basically the U.S. versus the Soviets sort of facing off through the various factions, using the various factions within the country. You know, our guys would be fighting their guys. So it would be a civil war sort of thing going on, but it had international implications. The big puppeteers were in there moving things around. So then my part in that was with Keith and Steve Drucker and Larry Domash. We went around and talked to some presidents, and, you know, mm-hmm. President Somoza, and you know, there's all kinds of stories. But anyway, there were a lot of anecdotal, you know, things happening. And you know, in Nicaragua, for example, the groups. Suddenly, the whole news changed, and the government gave amnesty for all these political prisoners, and the whole thing was softening up. And much to get into this. So, what happened? I'll tell everything. Somoza's, I think his wife meditated. That's how we got to talk to him. And Larry gave him this brilliant talk about physics and everything. And Somoza said, "You're just preaching," or something like this. Very Western education. He ran the country like it was his personal company business, you know, and this family kind of took all, and everybody's working for them. That's how I viewed it. I don't know if you want to put anyway. So I got really incensed, so I open up my briefcase and I pull out my slides. You know, it's like a Gatling gun. About 80 slides. And I pounded them.
And you made him watch all 80?
I pounded them. He was slumping down in his chair. So finally, but anyway, he never did anything. But what happened, the Sandinistas perceived that we were messing up their revolution.
Who were the Sandinistas?
They were the revolutionaries who were trying to change the government, bring down the government.
Bring down Somoza.
Bring down Somoza, yeah.
And they could see that something was softening.
Some of them came to our talks, as it turns out later we found out. So our Latin sort of initiators who organized this stuff said that after the Sandinistas won the revolution, and they had their victory parade, some of the guys who were the leaders who were riding in the parade, you know, sitting up in the top of the convertibles, they had been sitting in the front row of some of our lectures. And we had people ask questions.
Did they learn, or were they just checking you out?
They were just hearing what we were about.
Because you could have conceivably been yet another revolutionary.
Well, they're wondering, who are you? You know, there's all this stuff going on, all this international intrigue going on. Who are these people, you know? Who are these people? And they actually, in some places, they didn't. The revolutionary sort of, it wasn't in Nicaragua what they got up, and they were really kind of confrontational. They said, you know, well, what you're doing is just going to, you're just going to support the status quo, you know. We have to change the thing. You know, their theme of improving society was to topple the government and create a better situation. So, which happened anyway. So anyway, what happened was, in Nicaragua, we had our groups of guys meditating together, and they got a message from the Sandinistas, from the revolutionaries. Look, you guys are ruining our revolution, you know, you're making it all calm and everything. You have to get out of here, or we're going to come machine gun you. And so this was conveyed to Marashi, and Marashi said, get out of there. He's very practical. No, just, you know, whatever, you're not going to. And it was touch and go in Iran. There's some various stories there. I wasn't there, but I've heard them. But anyway, where it was just sort of some miracles that our guys, at one point they were brought outside and blindfolded and lined up against a wall, you know, for a firing squad, and then it didn't happen by some miracle. But anyway, so Marashi heard the story of Somoza and the Sandinistas, of course, and he told initiators to leave. And his comment was, he said, wherever he goes, he's going to regret this, that he didn't pick up on this knowledge and apply it, you know, like he could have. And so what happened to him was, is that he, you know, he fled the country, the revolutionary.
This is Somoza now.
Yeah, Somoza fled the country. There's other Nicaragua stories too. But anyway, he fled the country, and he was down in Paraguay, and in his armored car, and the Sandinistas followed him down there and blew him up with a recoilless rifle, and that was the end of that. So anyway,
so
why we were there in Nicaragua, I'll just tell one more thing. And so we also went to talk to the parliament guys, and we went to talk to the guy who was a sort of prime minister, I guess. And there were bullet holes, you know, through the wall. It was a masonry wall, and was little holes straight across the wall. Well, what had happened there was is that the Sandinistas had shown up dressed up like the military soldiers, a whole truckload of them sitting in the back, all with their arms. They showed up. They looked like their own soldiers. They jumped out. They took over. They kidnapped the entire parliament. and in that they did their machine gun thing and messed up the wall, but anyway they didn't kill them all or anything like that. But what they did was they ransomed them. They got a lot of money from the government to get their parliament back. Anyway, so they were very very trigger happy, you know. This guy we talked to, the prime minister, I guess he was. He had this. Guard who was holding, who had a machine gun. And so after we talked to him, we were sort of standing out in this nice patio area, sort of garden patio area, and it's a big government building that he was in. And the guy with the machine gun, he's coming out. The guy with the machine gun comes out first, and he's like really tense. And I could just feel that it was one of those moments, you know, where you're frozen and suddenly you have this expanded awareness, you know. And my awareness was, if you even sneezed or did anything unusual, that guy would just reflexively open fire. Because this whole thing had happened. And so we just kind of went on in like slow motion. We kept talking, doing this. And they came out, and then he relaxed, and the guy, and then the prime minister came out behind him, and they got in their car, and they went wherever they went. Anyway, there was lots of adventures like that in Central America.
Well, I'm sure we could go on and on, and I'm sure there are more adventures yet to come. And I'm hoping maybe we can have another conversation
just,
like this.
Yeah, just the scope of what Marashi was doing, and you know, changing world consciousness like that. It was unbelievable.
So thank you so much, David. So this has been A Chat with the Dean on KHOE World Radio 90.5 FM. And we've been having a lovely, lovely talk with Dr. David Orm Johnson. And I hope we can get you back again soon.
Thank you. Jay Gurdjieff.
Jay Gurdjieff.